last week when we first met, we gave an introductory shiur, but this is our first shiur where we actually discuss medical ethics for the modern age. And I wanted to begin with a series of two shiurim this week and next week on issues relating to fertility. There are many even more topics in the world of fertility that we could have studied, but I did want to limit it to two so that we can see other areas of medical halacha. And the two that we'll be discussing first today is the issue of artificial insemination, and then next week the more advanced but related topic of in vitro fertilization and IVF and gender selection and things such as that, which is even more complicated medically and more complicated halakhically. But we'll start with the basics, which, as you can see from your three pages of sources, is plenty involved even this week. The issue of artificial insemination, on the one hand, is simple, and on the other hand, obviously, is complicated. Generally speaking, a married couple who's having trouble conceiving will have, with the advances of medical science, a variety of possible options for them to pursue. In many cases, the first and easiest, quote-unquote, option, it would be an artificial insemination. And that is, again, in the layman's terms, called for when you have a situation in which basically both husband and wife are fertile. And for whatever reason, despite the fact that they seem to be fertile, they're not able to be successful in starting a pregnancy. And in some cases, the doctors, it's an amazing phenomenon, but the doctors can identify that even though the man's sperm may be fertile and should be able to work, for whatever reason, in the natural way that the sperm is deposited, it's not getting to the right place. And therefore, with a more targeted scientific deposit of the sperm, that can, even though we haven't changed any of the genetic material, we're not substituting or doing anything like that, and in our case, the actual conception would take place still naturally in the sense of it's inside the woman's body. We're not talking about what's what we colloquially call test tube babies, which is what we'll talk about next week. Here we're talking about, this is the most natural artificial remedy that one could perhaps have, in which you take a sample of the husband's sperm and it's directly deposited into the woman. And many cases, what couldn't have been done naturally, even though we're talking about the same genetic material, can create the miracle of a baby. That's the basic bottom line that we're discussing, and that's the scientific or medical reasons which might call for this kind of a therapy. Often, right away, doctors know that that won't work, or they try it and it didn't work, and then you have to move on to other types of therapies, and at least one other therapy is what we'll discuss, Amir Tashem, next week. A most basic introduction, though, to any topic in fertility is just to understand the role that Hashem gives us, the charge that Hashem gives us when it comes to having children, and specifically the dynamic role that the parents play along with the ultimate partner, and of course that is the Rabbono Shel Olam. If you take a look at just the opening few sources, just very briefly, to spell out the background, if not the hashkafa, that we have towards fertility, towards having children. Of course it goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden and Adam and Chava, where Hashem gives them that blessing and command of Peru Urevu Umilu Es Aretz V'Kivshuha. Right, Hashem placed them in the Garden of Eden not just to live alone and enjoy the retired life in Florida, but in fact to populate the world and then master the world. And obviously that involves many things which are not at all our topic. In fact, based on this pasuk, the Rishonim all assume that there is a positive obligation to have children, and as you'll see in source number 2 in the subtle formulation of the Shulchan Aruch, again, not our topic, but to be perfectly open, it should be, of course, noted that the specific chiyuv is on the man, not on the woman, and you see that already in the language of the Shulchan Aruch, chayiv kol adam lisa isha kidei lifros v'lerabo. So a man is obligated to get married so that he can then, obviously, hopefully, have children. And a man who doesn't even try, as you see from the language of the Shulchan Aruch, which is based on earlier sources, kilu shofech damim, it's a very, very strong condemnation. The idea of trying, at least, to have children is about as basic a Jewish and religious impulse as a person can have, and someone who would intentionally frustrate that and not even try is considered someone, again, in the words of Chazal and the earlier Rishonim, which the Shulchan Aruch is summarizing, as to be basically frustrating the entire plan of creation. It's that significant, and this is one of the most basic obligations that exists. It goes without saying, and I don't mean this to be a cliche or to get myself in trouble like I did last week, obviously that women play a role in having children. I think, right? And in fact, Rishonim, already Rabbeinu Nissim, the Ran speaks about the religious significance of the role. It's, again, I can't change what I can't change. The level of obligation is not the same. But the level of mitzvah is still significant. In other words, even if you're not obligated to shake lulav, if you shake lulav, it's a mitzvah. Obviously, there's a tremendous mitzvah in having children for men and for women. That goes without saying. When you then get into the traditional Jewish hashkafa about the role of women in motherhood, so that's a whole multiple series of shiurim, but you already went to seminary. That's not what I'm here for. But it is worth noting, and it will be relevant. It will be relevant, if not explicitly today, but you can keep it in the back of your mind, especially if you have had either personal or through your children or your grandchildren. This affects a lot more couples than you realize, because people don't usually talk about these kind of issues in public. But a lot of families, more than you may realize.
I was going to say that's a reminder. Okay, fine. And anyone else needs more shiurim, more source sheets? They're here.
Thank you.
Okay. And there's a water machine right outside if you need more water.
Thank you. So, obviously, keeping in mind when we go through this process, if a husband and wife are having trouble conceiving, so you could imagine, and this is sometimes real life, where there may be a certain emotional urgency that the wife feels, but that's not the same thing as the halachic urgency that the man may feel. And to what extent, when you have, and this is real life, ladies, one of the members of the couple wants to pursue a certain remedy and the other one doesn't. So how you negotiate that, not only the rabbi as social worker, but also rabbi as posek, may depend on which remedy and whose obligation and balancing that. I'm just giving you kind of background to just kind of sit, that's like lenses through which you can kind of keep all this information. This is all not stuff we'll be focusing on, but just stuff to keep in mind. More, I'd say, hashkafically, but really relevant to this any unit of halachic fertility issues are really the next two sources. And that is the Gemara Masechta Nida, which very famously says, when it comes to all children, Shlosha Shudfin Yesh Ba'adam, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Aviv V'Imo. At the end of the day, even though there's a basic biological way of reproduction, we all know that despite a husband and wife's best intentions, without the third partner, without HaKadosh Baruch Hu, there's not going to be anything. Not initial fertility, not conception, and even if you have a pregnancy, it doesn't mean it'll be a healthy pregnancy, a successful pregnancy, etc., etc. In fact, the Gemara in Masechta Chagiga, in Masechta Tainis in number 4, goes even further. Because you might have thought, well, you know, there's three partners, and just like we can kind of study the role of the man and the role of the woman, and maybe we could artificially recreate that or reproduce that, maybe we can figure out the role that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is playing as the third partner. Maybe we can somehow replace him, you would think, Chas V'Shalom. So the Gemara in Masechta Tainis, also a very famous Gemara, tells us, also coincidentally with the number 3, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Gimel Mavtechos B'yado Shal HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Shelo Nimsru B'yad Shliach. There's three things in the world which HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given, ultimately not given, I should say, that secret to, will never give, has never given, will never give, the true secret of two human beings. There will never be a shliach, no representative, no matter how well-meaning. Excuse me? That Hashem will never give, to, no matter how much people think they could understand, but there are three maftechos, the Gemara says, three keys, three secrets that Hashem keeps for himself. And one of them, the Gemara says, what are they? Eluhain, the issue of rain, Mavtech Shel Geshamim, right? You look at the news and the forecaster tells you it's going to rain tomorrow and they're right, what, half the time? You know, it doesn't matter how much studies they have in Doppler radar, it's a running joke, at least in America, that the meteorologists never, you know, they don't ever seem to ever know. Somehow, no matter all the studying and all the science, they still exactly haven't figured out the Mavtech of Geshamim. Tchias HaMesim, right? That seems to be obvious. No one's ever going to figure that out. That's Hashem's secret. And finally, the one in the middle, which is relevant for us, which is perhaps the most surprising. Mavteach Shel Chaya, birth. The ability to create life. And if you think about all the areas of medicine in which they've made so many advances, had so much insight, even in the last generation, fertility's up near, if not on the top of that list. The advances in fertility medicine are beyond belief. And yet, even now, as we stand here today, they do not understand everything, and they will never understand everything, because the Gemara tells us they will never understand. And there are couples who can have the best doctors and spend, and sometimes it can be very expensive, the vast amounts of money, and for no reason that any doctor could ever explain, they still cannot have children. It's a tragedy. I'm not in any way making light of that. Chas v'shalom. Of course, it's tragic. But it just underscores this point. To me, this Gemara is like prophetic. And you don't have to look further than our generation to truly appreciate the truth of this Gemara. At the end of the day, as much as the rabbi tries to help and the doctors try to help, in the end, that third partner is irreplaceable. And if HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in his infinite wisdom, is in an agreement, it's not going to happen. What's relevant when we discuss anything with the first word artificial, when we start talking about adding a fourth shutuf, the doctor, medical science, so then we're obviously getting to something a little bit more complicated. Because obviously, in a more natural, typical situation, we anticipate only three partners. Once we start adding that fourth partner, the doctor, so whatever you add a new partner, you're mixing up the cholent. And we have to figure out what is the proper role, what are the things that get affected by that artificial component, that new shutuf. So let's begin with the earliest sources that do anticipate, on some level, a form of artificial insemination. Again, in a typical case, I'll try to get into some of the more of the details later in the shiur, but we have a collection of the husband's sperm, the semen, which is then going to be inserted into his wife. So obviously, in the ways that they're doing it, along with Machon Pua, and you know, in the top hospitals in the world nowadays, they obviously didn't anticipate that. They couldn't have in the time of the Gemara. And yet, in Chazal, they did anticipate a form, perhaps more accidental, but they do anticipate the concept of a conception which does not occur in the biblical manner. And this is already quoted in the Gemara in Masechta Chagiga, in source number 5, where the Gemara is discussing the following halacha. The Kohen Gadol is only allowed to marry a woman who has never been married. It has to be a basula. If she was a divorcee or a widow, it's not a question of fault or guilt. She's simply not acceptable to be the wife of a Kohen Gadol. We all know that a regular Kohen, even Ariyom Hazeh, cannot marry a divorcee. But a Kohen Gadol can't marry anyone who is not a basula, not virginal. So the Gemara says in source number 5, Betula she'ibra, mahu l'kohen gadol. You have a woman who swears that she's pure as snow. She didn't do anything wrong, and she's pregnant. Maybe she already gave birth. And maybe, it's hard to know, maybe the Gemara, even on its level with its medical science, even checked. Maybe they even saw signs of basulim. So is such a woman allowed to marry the Kohen Gadol? And the basic question is very simply, despite what she's claiming, despite what our eyes may see, can we really believe that she's a basula if she's pregnant or had a baby? Right? Many a person has claimed, nothing happened. But eventually, hachush machish. Right? When the girls, right? And as you all know, this is one of the reasons that boys can be worse boys than girls can be girls. Because a girl can't get away with it. Right? So what do we do here? Do we allow this girl, despite her claims of innocence and purity, to marry the Kohen Gadol? And the Gemara says, perhaps yes. Well, what do you mean? How could you believe her? She's with baby. Chashinan shema ba'ambati ibra. The Gemara here conceives, pun intended, the Gemara here conceives of the possibility that a man could have been, in those days they had public bathhouses, that a man could have previously been in the bath, intentionally or unintentionally left a deposit there, and that later this woman was in the bathhouse, and that somehow through the medium of the water entered her body, and what do you know, sperm meets egg, and now she's pregnant and had a baby. There's been a lot of discussion throughout history in the Rishonim and Achronim to believe this Gemara. Is the Gemara meant to be literally? Is it possible? Hayitachein? And I didn't put any of those sources on the sheet because they're not relevant anymore, because this is not our discussion. What is striking, though, what will be relevant for us is not whether that could have happened. It's not relevant at all to us. What's relevant is that because the Gemara imagined such a situation, the Gemara and then the poskim after the Gemara can discuss what are the halachos of a conception which occurred not through natural biblical than, you know, way between man and a woman. In fact, beyond this Gemara, we have a very famous Midrashic tradition of a certain famous or infamous personality in Jewish history who, in fact, was born this way. The Medrash talks about Ben Sira. Any of you familiar with the name Ben Sira? Take a look. So source number 6 is one of the Midrashim that speaks about Ben Sira. Who was Ben Sira and why did he have that name? So the Midrash here gives a whole story. I won't read it all inside, but I have it here for those of you who want to take a peek at all of it inside. But the Gemara says as following. The Gemara says in the opening, the Midrash, in the top line, that he was born without there having been sexual intercourse. That's not how he was conceived. Below Be'ilas Ba'al. Well, how is that possible? So the Gemara says, well, before I explain it to you, I'll just make it more shocking to you. He is the son of the daughter of Yirmiyahu Hanavi, which means he's Yirmiyahu's grandson. But the Medrash tells us he's also Yirmiyahu's son. No, not Chas V'Shalom because Yirmiyahu did anything inappropriate with his daughter, but rather a different story. And the Medrash tells the story that once Yirmiyahu went to the bathhouse, and there were a bunch of bulvanim, some of the, you know, off the derech, wild kids who were there in the bathhouse. And they were acting in an inappropriate way, in ways which would leave sperm in the water, to be blunt. And he gave them musr for this. The Medrash is very vivid. He gave them musr for this. He's the Navi, that's the job. And they were tough guys, and they didn't take well to the musr. And he didn't have any backup. And they basically cornered him in the mikveh, if you will, in the bath. They told him, either you will do the same thing that we just did, or you're not getting out of here alive, basically. And the Medrash describes that as a result of this, there was a seminal emission from the Navi in the water. The Medrash speaks about how guilty he felt. He felt horrible. He feels that he did some terrible avera, some terrible act of tumah. Of course he was forced, but leave that aside. The Medrash says, Shemura haisa tipa shel osa tzadik. Somehow that emission was stayed viable in the water until, wouldn't you know it, who comes into the bathhouse soon after? His daughter. And the Medrash says that his daughter, who was, as I say, virginal as pure as snow, she's a Bas Yisrael, she didn't do anything wrong, and yet somehow she becomes pregnant from this encounter in the bathtub after her father had been there. Talks about Kevin Shiyolda, of course, when she's pregnant and when she gives birth, she's embarrassed. She's very embarrassed, says the Medrash. Haisa mit yabeshet mibnei adam, shayu omri mibznus yolda. Right? You want to be, you know, the Bas Yisrael, the daughter of the Navi. Could you imagine? The daughter of the Navi, the Rosh Hashiva's daughter. And she's promising, I didn't do anything wrong. And who believes her? No one would believe her. She's pregnant. She had a baby. Until finally the Medrash says that the baby himself, Patach Piv Hanar V'Amar L'Imo, the baby has, obviously with Ruach HaKodesh, tells his mother, what are you embarrassed for? Ben Sira Ani. And they say, well, what does Ben Sira mean? So the Medrash explains in the last two lines, Amar La Yirmiyo, the Navi, the father, obviously with Nevuah, explains also, Shehu Sar Shel Kol HaSarim V'Oti Litein Shem L'Kol Sar V'Melech. It's a representative not only of his lineage, he is a Meyuchas, he's the son of the Navi, but also in terms of the future influence that it'll have. It's a shame of kavod. Furthermore, points out that if you do the gematria, the word Sira and the word Yirmiyahu, begematria shavin. So in his name is an allusion to his unique origin. So here you have an example, and this tradition of Ben Sira is quoted widely throughout your tradition, including in halachic sources, as we'll see in a moment. So clearly, the halacha assumed that it was possible, not only in theory, but at least in one very specific example. The question for us, really, the game plan for today's shiur, is to answer a few basic questions. Number 1 and 1b, the mother is clearly the mother. However, she was impregnated, 9 months with the baby, labor, delivery, no one's taking that away from her. She is the mother. The question is he the father? What is the relationship between a father, a man, who is on the one hand the sperm donor, but on the other hand did not naturally cohabit with this woman to create the baby? The related point to that, of course, is if he has a mitzvah of pru urevu, does a man fulfill a mitzvah through such a child? Let's say he had a daughter in a natural way and a son this way. Is that the mitzvah of pru urevu or not? Is that the mitzvah of pru urevu? Number 1. Number 2 is if a couple says, I don't care whether it's a mitzvah or no mitzvah. I want a child. I can't have a child. This will help me. Is a couple allowed to do this? And here we'll discuss, towards the end of this year, two related points. Number one is, there's two types of artificial insemination nowadays, what they call AIH, which is the H being the husband, artificial insemination of the husband, and AID, from some other donor. Because even though I told you that a typical case with husband and wife, let's say the husband is simply not fertile. So what are the options? So one of the options would be to have the sperm of a complete stranger. The question is that allowed? Can a married woman be impregnated with sperm that's not her husband's? And within that question, if the answer theoretically would be yes, does it matter who the donor is? Is there a preference dafka for a Jew? Is there a preference dafka for a non-Jew? What are the issues? So these are some serious, serious issues, and these were heavily, heavily emotionally debated in the middle of the 20th century. So let's start hundreds of years before, and Emir Hashem, in 45 minutes to an hour or so, we'll be back in the 20th century, and we'll understand what the consensus is as we stand here at Yom HaZeh. So in terms of the basic question of whether there is a mitzvah or not, or what's the relationship between the male and then this child, which is the result of his biological contribution, even though clearly in a very atypical way. So here we have a very famous quote from one of the Baalei HaTosfos, Rabbeinu Peretz. Rabbeinu Peretz was one of the Rishonim from the Tosfos school, from the Baalei HaTosfos, and he's quoted in a number of other sources, including the Bach, in source number 7. The Bach was one of the great poskim, wrote a commentary on the Tur, and he quotes the halacha of Rabbeinu Peretz. Rabbeinu Peretz is dealing with the Hilchos Nida Shaila, but you'll see very quickly how that relates to our topic. We know that there's an issue called harchakos. Even when a husband and wife are, not only are they not allowed to be completely intimate, but there are certain harchakos, certain things that siyagim, certain cautionary things that they don't do. One of the issues that's discussed is, even by yourself, is it appropriate for, let's say, the husband to be sitting on his wife's bed, or for the wife to be sitting in her husband's bed? Now, you may know from your own married life or your own kala classes that we split the psak. That's the standard psak, is to split the psak. And that means that a married woman, not when her husband's in the bed, but when her husband's not in the room or in the bed, it's not considered inappropriate for her to be sitting in the bed. So that's exactly what Rabbeinu Peretz is discussing. He's just discussing it well before we knew that that was the halacha. He's before there was a consensus. And here, Rabbeinu Peretz splits the psak, but he discusses a wife on her husband's bed, or what if there was a Shabbos guest? Someone else, and she went maybe up after Shabbos to change the sheets, can she sit on that bed? He's not even in the house anymore. What's the concern, says Rabbeinu Peretz? Let's say now we're not dealing with water in the bathhouse, but maybe on the sheets. There was an omission on the sheets. What if she'll sit on the exact spot, unknowingly, where there was this seminal omission? Now, it's obviously very unlikely, but it's a little bit more likely than you think, because you remember that it wasn't so long ago in human history that people didn't wear fitted undergarments. So it is, again, even then, I assume it was very unlikely, very unlikely. Although probably a little bit more likely than in the bathhouse. But still, there is such a concern. There is such a concern. So Rabbeinu Peretz says the following. Look at source number 7. She should not, he asserts, she should not sit on the bed where a strange man, another man, not her husband, had slept. Pentit aber mishichva zera shalacher. Because maybe she'll get pregnant. You'll say, well, new, leave aside any other emotional issues, but like, what's the big deal? She didn't do anything wrong. The answer is, because in that case, what if she has, let's say, a baby boy, and really the father is this yeshiva kid who was over for Shabbos. Years later, that boy falls in love with a girl who wouldn't should know it. Oh my gosh, don't you remember 18 years ago? We haven't seen each other in so long, but I came to your house for Shabbos. I was in yeshiva. I got married right out of yeshiva. And guess what? Now I have a daughter who's perfectly aged for your son. Shema Yisa Ach Esachoso. Maybe brother will end up marrying sister without realizing. They could be half siblings. Now, admittedly, this is a, let's say, 1 in a million chance. But, number one, when it comes to issues of yichus and mamzerus and arayus, we're machmir even for 1 in a million. Number two is it's a lot more common even now than you think. Not that long ago, earlier this year, I saw on the internet, I actually printed it out to share with one of my seminary classes, just so they would think that I'm not completely crazy, or the Rishonim weren't crazy. Just Arayom is a case of a couple, of course, they were living together before they got married. Lama lo, right? It's 2012, come on. And now, I think they may even have a child, because again, why not? Chiddush is they're actually getting married. Can you imagine a couple wants to get married, even in 2012? So they're getting married, and now they realize that etel lachaim, or whatever they called it, and everyone's looking really familiar and looking Anyway, they did a DNA test. They're half siblings.
Oh my God.
They were half siblings. Could you imagine? So there are more than that, but that just happened a few months ago. Not in Eretz Yisrael. Anyway, the point is these things do happen. There are one in a million, but there is the one. There is the one. So Rabbeinu Peretz says you shouldn't do that. On the other hand, Rabbeinu Peretz says, and this is equally important for us, she can sit on her husband's bed. Why? Aren't you going to have the same concern? She's a nida. Husband and wife are not allowed to be together during this time. And what if she ends up getting pregnant at a time when she's a nida? Now, I don't mean that she's still having her period, because that would be biologically impossible. But let's say, yeah, she hasn't gone to the mikveh yet, but she could be fertile. She hasn't gone to the mikveh yet. So theoretically, she could be right in that time of the month where she could have a baby. Maybe it's the next day she's going to the mikveh. She could be in a very fertile time. She sits on the bed, and she'll get pregnant. But she's a nida. She didn't go to the mikveh yet. Says her better parents, it doesn't matter. Kaven de'ein kan bias iser, havlad kasher legamre, whether it would be her husband or anybody else. The nature of creating the avera, whether it's of nida with a husband or adultery with any other man, requires an illicit sexual act. Without that act, even though the result ends up being the same, that she's being impregnated at a time that she's not supposed to be, even from her husband, or from a man she's not supposed to be another man, that's not an avera. Yet, says Rabbeinu Peretz, we still practically split the psak in the sense that if it ends up being that it was her husband's sperm that impregnated her, so, you know, maybe they're getting a laugh in Shemayim, but in the end, no harm, no foul. If it ended up being another stranger, so then you get into this one in a million of maybe we could have some incest problem unknowingly down the road. Now, why is that? Let me just get a little further, okay? Why is that relevant? So sure enough, take a look. It'll be relevant for many things, but it's relevant already for the most basic question, which is, do we view the male as the father? So sure enough, this is a discussion in the Shulchan Aruch. Source number 8, one of the primary commentaries there, the Chalkas Mechokik, says, you know what, that's a really good question. I don't know. He has the question, right? What's the relationship between this man and this child? It's his DNA, but there was no physical relationship that created the baby. So says the Chalkas Mechokik, I don't know. He's not sure. He leaves it, but Sarach Iyun. But subsequent commentaries on Shulchan Aruch say they think they do know, and they want to bring a proof from what we just saw. So for example, the Beis Shmuel in source number 9, another commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, says, Yesh lahav yiraya mashakosuv v'agos smak v'habach, from the Tosus Rabbeinu Peretz. Nishma dahavi b'no l'chol davar. He says, you can bring a proof from that Nida case that we just said, sitting on the bed. Why? Because what was Rabbeinu Peretz's concern? That if it's a stranger, the Shabbos guest, Nebuch, that baby, the one in a million chance that the woman becomes impregnated, the baby will be his, let's say, son, and 25 years later, that boy may marry his father's sister, not realizing that they're half-siblings. That fear, which is what led him to Paskin, don't sit on the bed, is based on what assumption? It's based on the assumption that the man who did nothing other than leave the sperm deposit is in fact the father. And exactly that's what the Beis Shmuel says. Nishma dahavi ben l'kol davar. And he assumes it doesn't just mean his ben in terms of the yichus, but that the man would have a mitzvah, a puravu. Now it is worth noting, there is a dissenting view. Another commentary on Shulchan Aruch, the Taz. The Taz in source number 10, he says we could split our conclusion, by which I mean to say, I'll read just the underlined part, or right before that, he says, look, we say it lachumra velo lakula. Befrap emidi de toli bekum vasei hunit abra me'atzmo eino yotze bezeh. He says, when it comes to the chumra of saying, no, don't sit on the bed, no, we're worried, maybe there's going to be a one in a million case which is going to end up, you know, like on some you know, American talk show, you know, where they bring out the boy and then they bring out the girl, your sister, ah! Right? So one of those one in a million fears. I don't want to besmirch her good name now that she's in retirement, but I was thinking that. My mother is like a big fan, so I grew up with that name in my home. But she's retired now, so we don't make jokes about her. So in that one in a million case, says the Taz, yes, I have to be maskim. You see from that earlier source, obviously we view it enough, that man's child, that we could be worried that he would marry his half-sibling. But that, says the Taz, is not the same thing as the conclusion that other poskim wanted to reach, which is, if we're worried l'chumra, maybe we'd say the same thing l'kula, and therefore the man fulfilled a mitzvah of puravu. Why is it not the same thing? Because he assumes, and this would be, if we were giving a whole shiur just on puravu, we'd spend more time on this point, but I'll just tease it out for you now, and you can think about it. You'll see, because it clearly relates to issues of artificial insemination. He says the mitzvah of puravu is not just the result of having children, it requires the sexual act. Without that, there can't be a mitzvah. The fact that it's her egg and his sperm is not the mitzvah. It needs a maisa, the sexual act. And the fact that his sperm ended up producing a baby does not mean that he gets credit for the mitzvah, when he didn't even do that maisa. So the fact that we're worried that they shouldn't have an incest 25 years from now, that's one thing. But to draw a conclusion from that, that the man fulfilled the mitzvah, he's not willing to go as far. Ad hayom azed, this is a machlokus in the poskim. My own sense is that most poskim think that it is a mitzvah, but I don't think it's a consensus. And the couples that I've been involved with, in the end, everyone would rather fulfill the mitzvah. But I haven't met anyone who said, okay, I'm not going to do it because I'm not going to fulfill the mitzvah. What you do have, though, as we'll see, is there are some poskim who may prohibit the modern artificial insemination, and one of the things that they're saying is, in any way, you don't even fulfill the mitzvah. Now the question is, A, is that really true? We see that some poskim do say you fulfill a mitzvah without the sexual act. And B, maybe there are other values that could be accomplished. But this is just like the ABCs and the Aleph Beis. Yeah. Yes, this is absolutely connected, 100% connected, yes. If you assume that it's b'no l'chol davar, then you have that. If you assume that there's not really, it's just, we're worried about the incest, but we can't draw any conclusions from that, then ein hachanami. We'll discuss that a little bit, remind me, in case I forget, next week. Because if you have, well, anyway, I don't want to give away next week's shiur, then you won't come. Yeah.
In my professional work, I was involved in some aspects of artificial insemination, and the husband and wife were usually just told, you know, go home and have sex after the woman would have the procedure done with either the husband's sperm or the husband's sperm mixed with the stranger's sperm.
Are you discussing as a medical recommendation,
no,
or not a halakhic recommendation?
No, then
what was the reason? Just I have a reaction to what you're saying,
no,
but before I do that,
husband,
just what was the what's the medical reason for the recommendation?
No, it wasn't a medical reason. It was
emotional.
It was in some cases it was religious, so that the husband would still be fulfilling the mitzvah of having sex with the wife, even if they knew that the actual physical act wasn't there.
Okay.
For 5 years, for
okay.
Example,
yeah, I'm not sure. I don't want to. I have a feeling if I open the Pandora's box, this is going to be the rest of the shiur discussing this. So I'm not going to. But I'm not sure I understand that. I don't know who gave that recommendation. I'm not discussing.
This is routine.
I understand. So we give all sorts of recommendations, whether we be rabbis or doctors, which are more to help people's psyche. But if you ask me religiously whether there would be any benefit to that, I don't understand it at all.
Okay, say
I got it. I got it. I heard everything you said.
Then they go home and have sex. How do they know the baby can result from the sex?
Of course not.
Because they watch the
No. She's right. She's right. No, that takes that doesn't happen instantaneously like that. But what's the difference? They still, so that it's now, instead of knowing that it happened one way, they just don't know.
Right.
I don't see that in any way beneficial.
No,
I don't. That mitzvah doesn't require any connection to having a baby.
Yes, it does. No. The baby results.
No, but the mitzvah called ona of a husband and wife having a physical relationship has nothing to do with whether they have children or not. And it certainly doesn't require them doing this right after they were at the doctor's office. There's no connection. But I don't want to get too sidetracked by it, because as you can see, we have a lot more to do. I'd be happy and interested to speak to you more. I honestly don't understand why that makes any sense religiously. Maybe there are other benefits to that. I don't understand it. So let's continue. One issue, which we just need to get out of the way, just because it's very important practically, if this was an audience of men, I would probably spend more time on this and in more vivid detail than I will now. But there is the issue of procurement. How are we going to get the sperm? The doctors have no problems with this. The secular doctors have no problem with this. But as Rabbanim, of course, as religious Jews, we have a problem with this because there's a vera called Motzi Zera Levatala. So naturally, a person's allowed to have a sexual seminal emission, but in any way that is not the typical way of a husband with wife, so that obviously that's considered an avera. How serious an avera? What kind of an avera? That's like for yeshiva guys to discuss. But that's a speech to give teenage boys and others. But that's not for now at all. But there is an avera on the books. We take it certainly seriously. So when it came to all of a sudden now doctors saying, we want to do this, we want to help couples have babies, the question is how to do this. So in fact, the earlier post-scheme that discussed this were at least representing of both views divided. In number 11, you have the Divrei Malkiel. That was the Lomjerov, one of the great Gedolim of pre-war Europe. And the Lomjerov held that any artificial insemination is usser. There's nothing to talk about. We can end this year because there's no mutter way to get the sperm. Even though you'll tell me, because the wheels in your head are all turning, but you can't compare this to a typical situation of Zera Levatala, of masturbation, etc. Here we're trying to have a baby. Says the Lomjerov, it doesn't matter. There's only one correct, appropriate, halachically sanctioned way for a man to have an emission, and this ain't it. And therefore, he says, it is usser. There's nothing more to talk about. He adds the fact that anyway, the doctors might make a mistake. How do you know it's only going to happen once? Maybe they'll say it happened, they'll try once, it won't work, they'll try a second time. Maybe they'll mix in someone else's sperm because they want to make sure it works. There was a big distrust of the doctor in his tshuva. He's against the whole thing. But I could tell you, happily, that that is a minority view. Most poskim who discuss this ultimately feel, even though there are, and I'll briefly sketch some of the possibilities, even though there are different ways of procurement, and there may be halachically preferable ways, but fundamentally, they feel that in the pursuit of having a baby, you cannot call that levatala. Levatala, when it's not for the purpose of having a baby, it's for gratification. But here you have it for the purpose of having a baby. And just as two examples of this, but I could have given you many more, in sources 12 and 13, you have the Maharsham. That's the great Hasidic posek, the Rav of Brzezin. He was the grandfather and namesake of the very famous Maggid of Yerushalayim, Rav Shalom Shwadron. The Maharsham is Rav Shalom Shwadron. That was his grandfather and his namesake, who was one of the great, great Galatianer poskim in the earlier part of the 20th century. And yet you have, from a relatively similar time period, of course, although from a very different part of Europe, the Sridi Eish, the great Yaakov Yechiel Weinberg, who was the great Rav in Germany, and then after the war he was a survivor, spent the rest of his life in Switzerland. So both the Sridi Eish and the Maharsham both fundamentally say that when we're doing this in the pursuit of having a child for fertility purposes, it's totally mutter. If you take a look just at the conclusion of number 12, davka derech hashchasa aser, if it's being done just for waste. We know the biblical model of this, of course, was onan, right? It's just on the ground. That's nothing. Ubenidon didon sh'osa manas latakein v'osa zera atzmo. But here where they want to use that very sperm, that very seed, that zera, to then have a baby, that's not levat tala at all. And basically, the Sridi Eish said the same thing. That's when you're wasting it. Just low alidehabi'ila. Yes, they're going to use that sperm in the furtherance of trying to have a baby. Not through intercourse, through the medium of the medical help. But nevertheless, it's the same thing. You're having this admission to have a baby. There is therefore nothing wrong. That is the consensus of the poskim. I'm sure there's somebody somewhere who thinks it's usher, but it's not a mainstream view. The mainstream sock, and as far as I know, this covers all of the shvatim. From the Hasidic community to the more modern community, as far as I know, it's pretty much mekubal. Certainly, Rosh Shlomo Zalman Orbach, Rosh Moshe Feinstein, all okayed it. Tzitz Eliezer has a tshuva. Now, there are different ways, even at Hayom HaZeh, there are ways. There are times, for example, where a husband and wife can be together in a completely normal way, and then right away, I thought you were getting to this before you threw that curveball a few minutes ago, then they can do a retrieval of the sperm from inside. That is by far the most halachically preferable. Everything happened naturally. The only difference is what happened afterwards. That's one possibility. That always doesn't always work, but theoretically that's an ideal. There are times where there are special condoms that are used. When I say special, I mean because usually condoms have spermicide. that wouldn't work for this case. There are some poskim, Rav Neubert has this, Rav Shlomo Zalman apparently has such a hidur, that they poke a little bit of a hole in the condom, so some of the sperm actually is deposited directly inside the woman. But fundamentally, the goal is to have the condom to retrieve the sperm from there. If those wouldn't work, are there some other possibilities still? So that's a little bit of a debate of the poskim. But between those two options, the first two I mentioned, most cases can be taken care of. I had a specific case when I was a rabbi in Baltimore. I was consulted. The family, one of the members of the couple was from a different community in America, and he asked his posek over there. And we both agreed with the same thing, that if the doctors were telling him that with this condom it could work, that would be the way, that is a consensus, an accepted way to go among the poskim. So that's, now we have that probably a mitzvah, probably still the, also halakhically 100% the father. We now know how we're more or less going to retrieve the sperm, and now the question is, lamaisa, are we really allowed to do this? Are we really allowed to do this? What other issues might there be? Anyone want to take it? Why would you, I'm not going to ask why you think we should do this, because why we should do this is self-evident. Why would you think this would be a bad thing, halakhically? Assuming that it's not a problem of zara levatala, which we're saying is not the majority of you. What other reasons why you be against this? Right, right. The first word of the shear is artificial. Right, maybe we're not supposed to be doing things that are artificial. That's a possibility. Good. Anything else?
We're not supposed to do medical procedures for no reason.
Okay, so there's a certain risk that may be involved. It's pretty minimal, but it's a little, anything that's invasive could be considered risky. Yeah?
I mean, there might be some doubt that they put the correct sperm into the...
Okay, there's the practical issue, which will be an especially big problem next week for IVF. It's a much more acute problem with IVF, because that's even more artificial. Which is, how do we really know who's the father? In artificial insemination, we know who the mother is. But what? You're trusting doctors. You're trusting nurses. And there are cases, you can Google it if you want to have a nightmare. There are horrible, horrible cases. Horrible cases. Dafka, again, fertility is where you find some of the biggest tzaddikim as far as the doctors, and the biggest rishayim. And the biggest rishayim. Because people have gotten very, very rich because they have a 99% success rate. And in one particular Risha's case in New York not long ago, is because over 100 of the babies were the doctors.
Wow.
So this is a factor. Yes, it's sickening, sickening. Anyone else have any issues that they want to mention? Well, I'll just throw something out there just to make things complicated, which is, it's one thing if we're talking about the husband and everything you said is relevant, but what if the husband is totally infertile? What then? A stranger, a donor, AID. So most poskim, in fact, it's so obvious or so consensus that I didn't even really put sources for it on the sheet, other than they're by implication, say if we're talking about the husband, the biggest halachic fear people had was the issue of zera levatala, but once we overcome that for the various reasons that we mentioned, in principle, as far as I know, virtually, if not literally, poskim are not against the consensus psak for sure, is to allow artificial insemination with the husband. The issue of making sure that we have the right sperm is obviously a factor, but again, in this case, it's much easier because the amount of time that you're relying on doctors and nurses is far less. When you do IVF, again, I don't want to get into next week's year today, but there it's much, much more reliant, of course, on the medical technicians. Nevertheless, it is recommended, and certainly if you're living in Eretz Yisrael, you have the benefit of doing this with the help of something like Machon Pua. You can have mashgiach. There's a whole field of mashgichim that are not watching the lettuce. If you were going to be a mashgiach, you know, which one would you choose? The problem is there's more hotels than fertility clinics. But the bottom line, that's exactly the word they use. They have mashgichim, they have hashkacha, and they will make sure and they will see that everything is done kadas ukadin. But now the issue, this is really what I want to spend the last time we have together for the shiur, is the issue is mainly, what about if the husband's simply infertile? What do we do then? So this was a big issue in the earlier part of the 20th century. In fact, I have a cousin who grew up on the Lower East Side as a boy, and he remembers exactly when this happened. Not only because this is like more exciting than arguing about gebrucks or something, but because if you lived on the Lower East Side, everyone knew about this because it was such a tumult. And the whole world was surrounding Rav Moshe Feinstein on this. Because Rav Moshe Feinstein had a landmark revolutionary psak which many, many other poskim did not like, most notably in America, the Satmar Rebbe. And my cousin, who's now in his 60s, he remembers, as I don't know if he was a kid or an adolescent, he remembers, how shall I say, representatives of the Satmar Rebbe coming down to the Lower East Side to speak with Rav Moshe about the topic. The Satmar Rebbe was not the only opponent of Rav Moshe, but the other opponents, as we'll see, were living in Europe and in Eretz Yisrael. So the one who was point man for the opposition became the Satmar Rebbe. Of course, he is a Lebedik personality anyway, so even if he had lived in Europe, he would have wanted to be the point man on this particular debate. So what did Rav Moshe say? So Rav Moshe, I'll give you two of his original tshuvas in sources number 14 and 15. Rav Moshe there writes, you see the date, right? Yom HaTzmut, right? That's Tavshin Chet. So this is Tavshin Yud Tet. That's 11 years later, right? The late 1950s. V'dover mashin ishalti me'reyato, right? Basically, a rabbi sent a shaila to Rav Moshe because the Rebbetzin spoke to that rabbi, hopscotch and a jump, who then spoke to, right? This, especially in those days, people were very embarrassed. A couple was too embarrassed even to go to their own Rav, let alone to Rav Moshe. So the woman went to the Rebbetzin went to the Rav, and the Rav said, I have no idea. So the Rav said, dial up Rav Moshe. What's the story? So Moshe says, which is important in general for our whole semester, in the second line, I delayed in responding to you because I had to spend time talking Eitzel Rofim Mumchim. No responsible Rav is going to make a psak like this without knowing the science. So Moshe consulted with the doctors. V'din zera acher mefurish le'isur mishum harav ben parent. It says, prima facie, at first glance, it would appear that any non-husband should be usur. If it's usur for the woman to sit on the bed, he says, from Rabbeinu Peretz, because maybe one in a million she'll get pregnant and not know the true identity of the father. Well, as you all know, when it comes to artificial insemination, right, these are blind donations. They will not tell you. They will not tell you who the actual father is. So you're never going to know. So you'll say it's a one in a million. Okay. But one in a million, the baby that you become impregnated with from your blind donor might end up, you know, going on a shirch date with Malka, who's also... It's possible. So Moshe says, if that would be it, it would be totally usher. But, he says, what was the issue, as I just mentioned? An issue of unlikely but possible incest. Well, what does incest require? Well, it either requires sharing both parents, which they obviously aren't going to in this case, or at least halachically sharing one parent, sharing the father. What, says Moshe, is an ingenious way to get out of that problem? To use a non-Jew. What you would have thought would be the worst thing, and we'll see other poskim did think this is the worst thing, Rav Moshe thinks that it's so crazy it might just work. If you use a non-Jew, we have a halacha, which is that there is no yichus. A Jewish woman and a non-Jewish man, let's say chalila, a nice Jewish woman has an affair with a non-Jewish man, and they have a baby. That halachically, that man is not the baby's father. The baby has no father halachically. There cannot be any yichus between a non-Jewish man and a Jewish woman. And therefore, says Rav Moshe, if you have a donor, who we don't need to know if he went into Harvard, and we don't need to know if he's an athlete, we just need to know that he's not Jewish. And then Rav Moshe adds chiddush upon chiddush, even if we can't confirm that 100%, says if you're in America, where the overwhelming statistical majority of people are not Jewish, we can assume that the donor wasn't Jewish. If the donor is not Jewish, there is no father. Even if you have a nice little Maishala who one day falls in love with Malkaleh, and even if Malkaleh, one in a gajillion, is also the product of a sperm donation from the same anonymous guy, it won't matter because they don't have the same mother, obviously. And even though they have the same biological donor for the sperm, it doesn't matter because there's no halachic relationship. Now, whether you would want to know that you were marrying your biological sibling even though it wasn't your halachic sibling is a different issue. But says Rav Moshe, that is the end around the halachic problem. If you use a non-Jewish donor, you will have no problem. I'll just read you the one key line here. Five lines down in the middle, Yesh lahatir bezera shel nachri. Kevasha havladya Yisrael. Kevasha imo Yisraeli. The baby's 100% Jewish because of the Jewish mother. Ein lachush laklum. There's nothing to worry about. The ein lo yichas la'ava nachri. There's no relationship to the sperm donor. Ulechein yish lahatir b'shas hatchak gadol umitztari ma'od b'shtokakim l'vlad. He says, obviously, this is not like an ideal situation at all. But if there's a tremendous need, what defines tremendous need? The parents desperately want to have a child. And as he mentions in other tshuvas, there has to be complete agreement by the husband. If a woman would do this behind her husband's back, that'd be grounds for divorce, says Ramosha. But if there's an agreement from the husband and the wife wants to do this, she so much wants to have a child, Ramosha says this is the halachic way to do this. He repeats this in source number 15, which is another tshuva. He basically makes more or less the same point. And he adds, Chas v'shalom, no one should think that there's anything inappropriate about a woman having this sperm deposit from another man. So, oh, it's adultery, it's not her husband. Says Ramosha, no, we go back to those sources, Rabbeinu Peretz, we saw. It's only adultery or something inappropriate if there is a prohibited act of intercourse. But if there's no sexual act, says Ramosha, then there's nothing halachically wrong. Period. Now this, I just, because we're running late, I want to just try to get through a highlight of the other tshuvas. I want to end so that the next teacher can start, but if there's some time in between, I'm happy to stay for questions, but I just want to end for people who have to run. And that is, these tshuvas, when they were produced, I got a sense from, I could hear some murmurings, and I could see a little bit of a shocking psak, right? I get a sense that some people in this room were not 100% comfortable or not necessarily expecting such a psak. Well, that is only barely can articulate the reaction that Ramosha got from his contemporaries. Virtually all of the other poskim were scandalized by Ramosha's psak. To give you just a few examples, one of the main ones was the Chalkas Yaakov. Chalkas Yaakov is Rav Yaakov Breisch, a Rav in Switzerland. The Sridei Eish, in source number 17, who originally wrote the letter to the Chalkas Yaakov. Look at number 16, Yedidi HaRav HaGoyin of Yechiel Weinberg, who originally wrote a letter to the Chalkas Yaakov, and then in source number 17, he wrote his own Shuva. And they both came to the same conclusion that they don't know what Ramosha Feinstein is thinking. But how could it possibly be? It is just inconceivable to them that such a thing should be allowed. What's the problem? So they both say, Chalkas Yaakov says in source number 16, he agrees in theory from Rabbeinu Peretz, and 16, the third line, Hadin Barur Shehavlad Kasher Kshenolad Mishach Pazer Shal Acher Shelo Aide Bias Isser. He says if there's no prohibited sexual act, he is agreeing with Ramosha Feinstein's lumdus, if you will. Technically, Ramosha Feinstein dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's. He's willing to grant Ramosha Feinstein on the record, he's okay. The woman didn't do anything wrong, the baby's not going to be tainted, baby doesn't have a father, but halachically, but there's nothing wrong, the baby's not a mamzer, the baby's not a pogum, the woman didn't commit adultery, they're maskim on that. And yet he still says, nevertheless he says, usher gomor mitzad hadin. Totally usher. Is what Ramosha finds he's thinking. Hagam mitzad regesh hadas v'hayadus hum tu eves kinaan umitzrayim. And this is the point which is the most, it's not the only one, we'll see others in a minute, but the most common objection to Ramosha, if you wanted to be cynical, you could call it emotional, but I don't think it's that. It's that we live in a world not only of technical halachos, we also live in a world of hashkafa. And these great gedolim felt that Ramosha Feinstein was proposing is not just inconsistent with Jewish values. It is, as some of the other tshuvas mentioned, it is horeis, all of das, it's turning the whole religion on its head. Hayitachin, a married Jewish woman, a Bas Yisrael, is going to be impregnated by a guy? Just say the words yourself and see what your initial visceral reaction is. They couldn't believe such a thing. You could recommend a married woman to be pregnant by a man who's not her husband? And not even Jewish? This is what happened to Kedushas Yisrael? It's one thing to say, well, the baby's 100% Jewish and it all comes from the mother, rah, rah, rah. But doesn't the father play some role? We don't care at all about the biological origins of this child. They're just scandalized. And there's some very passionate tshuvas back and forth. That was the overarching major emotional concern.
What year was that?
Late 50s, early 60s.
Could they quote any halakhic?
Yes. Then there are a number of halakhic concerns. Again, I'm sorry that we're running late, but we had a really good discussion, and obviously we started a little late also because of the siren, so I'm not going to be able to do too much of the rest of the sources inside. But one of the big arguments they make starts off with a Ramban. Ramosha Feinstein has this Rabbeinu Peretz, right? But how many of you heard of Rabbeinu Peretz before today? You've all heard of the Ramban, right? So the Rabbeinu Peretz is a Rishon, but the Ramban is the Ramban. And the Ramban seems to say, now it's important, that he's not speaking in his halakhic works. It's the Ramban's commentary on the Chumash. But the Ramban points out that the Torah's formulation, not necessarily Dibros, but more broadly, about the prohibition of adultery is a very weird formulation. El Eishes Amisecha Lo Titein Shechavtecha Lezera Letamaba. Instead of saying a man shouldn't have a sexual relationship with a married woman, basically the Torah formulates it as a man shouldn't deposit his sperm in a married woman. That's a really weird pasuk, don't you think? So the Ramban says, you know why the Torah formulated it in that awkward way? To teach you that what's the essence of the Isser of adultery? The idea of having the sperm of anyone who's not the husband inside a woman's body. That is in essence the Isser. Ki lo yuda hazera lemihu. Because after all, then, you're going to create a generation, a situation where you don't know who the father is. So the tam, the whole reason, it's not just, you know, the made in heaven, you know, oh, how could you betray? Says the Ramban, it's much more down to earth. Once you have another man's sperm inside the woman's reproductive tract, who knows what's going to happen, and we're not going to know what happened. It'll be to'ebos gedolos v'ros l'shneihem. So among others, the Satmar Rebbe, I didn't put any of his own tshuvas on here, but here you have in source number 19, the Chalkas Yaakov quoting on the bottom, the Rebbe of Satmar, he paskin like this Ramban. And he said, my Ramban trumps your Rabbeinu Peretz. You're telling me it's not adultery, because Rabbeinu Peretz said the woman could sit theoretically on the man's bed, it's just that we're worried that the one in a million incest problem. And Rav Moshe Feinstein deduced from that, you see that it's not adultery. Says Satmar Rebbe, you're right, according to this Rabbeinu Peretz, whoever he is. In all seriousness, of course he respects Rabbeinu Peretz. But he says, but the Ramban disagrees. In other words, said the Rebbe, a woman who's impregnated with the sperm of another man, even if it's in a doctor's lab, is an adulteress. And the child would be a mamzer. Is that halachic enough? Very halachic. Moreover, the Sri Deish has a number of practical issues. What do you think the odds are of a couple who got impregnated this way, sitting down with little Shleime at his bar mitzvah, at his high school graduation, and saying, you know, Tati, he ain't Tati. What are the odds, right? Even adopted situations, all sorts of situations which are relatively complex, but not nearly as complex as this. Lots of couples, especially in the 1960s, you could argue that maybe we're a little bit more open-minded about certain things today, but how many couples would sit down and say, you should just know your father's not your father, and it's, you know, George from the other side of the tracks. Or better yet, I don't even know who it is. It's a complete stranger guy. So Sri Yesh is very worried that they're never going to tell the child. So you'll say, not only, well, so first of all, you could have all sorts of problems from that. Number one, let's say the man dies. This child thinks that they're a Yoresh. Any money that they would take by Yerusha would be stealing, either from the wife or from other children. Let's say there's only one child, and it's this child. And then the husband dies. So really, 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 the woman needs Yibum or Chalitza. But then she'd have to admit to the world that this 18-year-old boy is not really her husband's child. Is she going to be willing to do that after 18 years of secrecy? Probably not, says the Sri Yesh. So you're setting yourself up for all sorts of halachic concerns. Now, none of them are as grave as adultery, obviously. But Sri Yesh, you know, once they started going, you know, every Isser they could find, they threw at Rav Moshe. Yes, so other than the issue of incest will not be a problem with a non-Jewish donor. But all the other concerns will be. You still need chalitza, the Yerusha would be stolen. Yeah, anybody. But as long as it's not the father's child, the husband's child. Yes, yes, they're against it.
Either way.
Yes, yes, it's terrible. Yes.
How do you cause such a child
from
the Torah?
It's also a Shiloh. I'm not that there are answers for. You have issues with.
That's the same with an adopted.
Yes, yes, yes. But it's a fair point. But that there are other issues which are even more serious. So if you turn the page, we'll just try to conclude in the next few minutes. We'll see our motion's response. Turn the page. Yes. Well, I'm going to skip 20 and 21. We don't have time for it. But there are others. Again, the Minchas Yitzchak in 21. The Minchas Yitzchak is Diane Weiss. He was the Rav in Manchester, and then he made Aliyah and was the Rav of the Eidah Charedis in Yerushalayim. Diane Weiss, the Minchas Yitzchak. So he was very close. He talks about how when this all happened, when the news broke from America, wouldn't you know it, the Satmar Rav was in London. So the Satmar Rav and the future head of the Eidah Charedis, obviously HaKadosh Baruch Hu had a plan. They should both be in England. So they could be equally upset at Moshe. So they're very, very upset. They found another Rishon, the Shilte Giborim, in source number 20, who's also against, they say, Rabbeinu Peretz and Ramosha. So it's nice, Ramosha has all these sources, but they're counteracted by other sources, and there's all these other concerns that they're very against. So source number 22, we have the Tzitz Eliezer. And the Tzitz Eliezer basically goes back to the source, if you will, which I think really is the ultimate point, clearly, which is that most poskim simply couldn't stomach this. They just couldn't stomach it. Whatever answers you'll give me, it won't change the facts. Right? And you have a right to your own opinion, you don't have a right to your own facts. And the facts are, we're impregnating a married Jewish woman from a non-Jew. And for them, it just stopped. And Tzitz Eliezer, who's writing later, so he had a chance to kind of survey a little more of a sober and calm environment. He looks at all the tshuvas from the initial flurry, and it was a big, big flurry back and forth. I think the Chalkas Yaakov himself wrote 11 tshuvas or something like that on the topic. I mean, this was, for only a teeny percentage of the population of Jews, but for that population, for those few years, this was like the most important halacha issue that they were discussing. They didn't have time to worry about bugs and shaitels and all sorts of other things because they were worrying about non-Jewish sperm, okay? So it was a very, very, very passionate debate among these poskim. And even years later, the Tzitz Eliezer writes, and it's just worth it, we'll see a little bit of his language and then we'll end with Rav Moshe Feinstein's response. But he says, again, at the end of the day, what's the bottom line? The idea of putting another man, let alone a non-Jewish sperm, into a woman, to'eva gedola hi be'elohe Yaakov. It's bringing an abomination into the tents of Yaakov. Ein lecha chilul mishpachti gadol mizeh b'mishkanos Yisrael. There cannot be a greater chil Hashem in the tents of the Jewish people, in the home of the Jewish people. Zohoreis kol ha-musagim ha-nealim shal tohar v'kedushas chayim mishpachat Yisraelim sh'ameinu mitztayein behen me'oz ha-yoso l'goy. From the time of Rabbi Bilam, Matov Alecha Mishkanos Yaakov, the Jewish family is like the model for all societies, the Jewish family, the Jewish marriage, a Jewish husband. This is like throughout societies. I grew up in the Midwest in America in the early 70s and 80s, even among my non-religious or non-Jewish friends, everyone, you got to have a Jewish husband and a Jewish family and a Jewish marriage. Says it says that we're taking what was the crown jewel of Judaism and we're corrupting it. What bigger Chil Hashem is there than that? How could it be? He ends off by saying really the same thing. Kol hadiburim yutarim. Says anything I say, I can't, it's unnecessary. It's all superfluous. This cure, this zuama, this terrible contaminated thing, a churban nora. Says all the other details are just details. That's the bottom line. Now, I will add one other thing, which in number one of the interesting things in number 19, I'll just add this because it's so interesting. One of the things that the Chalkas Yaakov threw at Ramosha is that the Catholic Church prohibits this. And the Catholic Church. We'll see this a similar point when we get to abortion in 2 weeks. The Chalkas Yaakov felt that that's relevant. He said that they should be more worried about Tzinias than us. They should be more worried about the Kedusha of a family than us. He also felt that's a Kiddush, a Chil Hashem. So they're throwing everything at Ramosha. So Rav Moshe has three other tshuvas on the topic.
What is the Catholic Church?
Artificial insemination. Yeah. I don't know what their feeling would be about a husband and wife. They may be against even that, I'm not sure. But they were certainly against having another man who's not the husband. I'm not sure how they feel about Goyim. give me a minute, okay? I just want to finish, okay? Let me just finish, please. In the last three tshuvas, we have a fascinating phenomenon. On the one hand, I want to be crystal clear, Rav Moshe does not back down for a moment. He takes their best punch and he does not fall to the canvas. Rav Moshe has answers for everything. He says, it's nice that, he goes, I don't mind at all. They apologize. You know, they were not talking about you or me here. They're talking about Rav Moshe Feinstein. It's pretty emotional language. And then they of course, it started off with, Michael Zion, but you're Shegiz. You know, whenever someone says, you forgive me, you know what's coming. So, you know, they meant it, but they let out a torrent. And Rav Moshe says, you don't have to apologize. This is Derech HaTorah, you really believe that, that's okay. You just happen to be as wrong as you are passionate. That's exactly what he says to them. He says, you're completely wrong. I thought about everything again out of respect for you, and you don't know what you're talking about. And it says, you're completely wrong. He goes point by point to explain to them, even you said before, even the issues of Chalitza or Yerusha. Sir Moshe says it's the same problem with an adoption, especially in the 1960s, where no one talked about adoption. But do we, yes, there are issues that could come up with adoption, but do we aser adoption? No! Unless you're Lubavitch, because the Rebbe did, but that's not the topic for today. Okay? So, what, for the mainstream, the Stipler, others were very pro-adoption. So there's other concerns. We'll deal with the concerns. We don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Sir Moshe Feinstein says that's not a concern. And your Ramban, come on, the Ramban is a commentary on the Torah. It's Tami HaMitzvos. The Ramban is the Ramban, but this is not the Ramban speaking as a posek. This is the Ramban speaking as a mafarsh on the Torah. It's a nice sashkofa drush. But that's not a psak and hukos nida. That's not a psak and hukos adultery. And Sir Moshe wiped every one of them. The story, by the way, that my cousin Lori Sai told me about the Satmar representatives that were sent to talk to Rabbi Shah. So the legend, I don't know if it's really true, but the legend on the Lower East Side was that the Satmar Rebbe told the people, whatever you do, don't talk about halacha. Because they knew that Rabbi Shah Feinstein would wipe the floor with them. So, you know, that's why I say, whatever else they may or may not have said to Rabbi Shah, apparently they were given strong instructions, don't get into halachic debate. You're going to discuss halacha, but don't talk about halacha. Because Rav Moshe Feinstein is Rav Moshe Feinstein, and he had an answer for everything. So that's all point number one. With all of that torrent of articles against him, he did not back down ad yomoso. At the same time, he reiterates in numerous tshuvas that he, in essence, agrees with them anyway. But he agrees with them that this is not ideal. He doesn't want it. And he says in the last time, number 25, he says, the only time I was ever lemaisa asked, I said no. So even though on the books, Rav Moshe Feinstein apparently felt strongly that what he said has firm foundation, he never backed down, he never gives in, but he says, I'm never comfortable with it, it's not lechachila. He would rather a couple either not have children or adopt rather than do this. If you had asked him, he does not think this is a good idea. He agrees this is bidyeved. He agrees this is not exactly the Jewish way. He agrees that this could potentially cause lots of problems. He agrees this creates shalom bias problems with husband and wife. There could be a lot of issues. He's not a fan of it. And he says explicitly in these last three tshuvas, even though in number 23 he gives all the answers, but he mentions there, and especially in 24 and 25, Lamaisa lohoresi laasos kain, this is number 24, I never paskin to do this. Mitam shel inyan kiyum mitzvos puravu lavala ein zam klum. And Rav Moshe Feinstein himself thinks that maybe there's no mitzvah. So you'll say, but so what? But what about all the emotional? She wants a baby. She wants to be a mother. So Rav Moshe Feinstein recognizes that, which is why he has his original psukim.
But it's not
other poskim felt yes, but even Rav Moshe felt not. Correct, because if it's the husband is one thing, but here there's we don't know, there's some stranger. So there's no mitzvah here. What's going on? It's nachas ruach, and he's not. Neither am I, and so then Rav Moshe Feinstein are making light of that. A woman who's been barren for years and wants to have a child, this is the only way. So that's in the end why Rav Moshe said it's mutter, because he understood the value of that. But Rav Moshe clearly is torn. You see, mamish a gadol be Yisrael torn. You don't always get to see a window into a person's heart. Usually, we just see their minds. If you go through these, and again, I'm sorry, we're not reading it all inside, but you will see a man torn. You could say in a certain sense, I would say between his mind and his heart, but it's not really, because his heart is torn. He has rachmanis on the need, but he also has rachmanis on the Jewish people. And he does not think that this is a good thing for the Jewish people. And therefore he says, A, I never really allowed it. And in the last letter, he says even specifically, he says, that the one time I was asked, b'she'ela hachad pa'amit shabol yadi asarti. Now, he doesn't tell us why, or what exactly. But he says, I'm not ideal, I'm not a fan. The one time I personally ever asked, I said no. But yet, he never retracts, and that's an important thing. Because ad hayom hazeh, there are couples, depending on who the Rav is. There are some Rabbanim who will say, look, you see, Moshe was against it, the whole world was against it, you can't do it. But there are Rabbanim, I know of cases, and we'll discuss a little bit of this in the IVF shear next week, because it's not exactly the same thing, but it's a similar thing. If the man is infertile, the man is infertile. So IVF was colloquially called a test tube baby. So if it's the deposit is from a man other than the husband, you have the same issue. So it's discussed in IVF as well. And there I know of a fact, there are definitely some gedolim even living today in Eretz Yisrael in particular, and in America, who, if there is no other way, have allowed, for example, IVF, even from a donor. Obviously, it's not ideal, but we're not talking about an ideal situation. So there are poskim who are willing to rely on our Moshe, b'shas hadchag gadol. There are other poskim who aren't. Now that you're a much more informed, if you will, consumer, and you understand the background, so this will certainly underscore the importance of having a posek, someone whose judgment you trust, someone who understands you and halacha. And like everything in halacha, but this is one of those really important areas, if it should ever be an issue with a member of your family or somebody that you know, you understand this is a very serious shaila. The answer may be that it's appropriate to do, but there are a lot of reasons why the answer may be it's not. And Amir Tz Hashem, there should be lots of babies born to the Jewish people.